The following is a live presentation of CITR News.
CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast.
And now here's your host, Carrie Baptist.
Good evening. On the program tonight, we'll bring you a live interview with UBC Greenpeace Association President Danny Pope. Danny joins us in studio this evening to talk about the Greenpeace's campaign to urge grocers to stock more sustainable seafood. We'll also bring you the story of the Little Mountain Housing Project, which is currently being demolished. Protesters and squatters could not prevent the demolition from going ahead, and on Tuesday night, a fire broke out at the site. Finally, we bring you an interview with Simon Fraser University criminology professor Neil Boyd, talking about his recent book, A Thousand Dreams, which suggests some new innovative solutions to the current situation in Vancouver's downtown east side. We'll have all this, plus your weekend weather forecast coming up this hour right here on News 101. First, I'd like to tell you about CITR's annual fund drive. CITR is the voice for the economically, socially, and politically disadvantaged. We provide an alternative We provide an alternative perspective that you won't find elsewhere on your radio dial. Our locally relevant, vibrant, and I can't do this.
We provide an alternative perspective that you won't hear elsewhere on your radio dial. Our locally relevant, vibrant, and vital radio can only be heard with your support. That's why we're asking you to please call 604-822-8648 or 604-UBC-UNIT and pledge your support. This afternoon, we have the pleasure of having Danny Pope join us in the studio. Danny is the president of UBC Greenpeace Association and joins us to talk about the Out of Stock campaign, a program to protect dwindling fish populations by calling for grocery stores to change the way they purchase seafood.
Hi, Danny. So tell us a little bit about this campaign.
Well, Carrie, basically what we're trying to do is make people aware of the fact that we're largely running out of fish in our oceans. And I mean, that's kind of a shocking thing to think about, but it's true. And what we're really doing right now is we're trying to make people aware of this by holding a screening of a film this coming Wednesday, that's November the 18th, in Buchanan B310 at 6 p.m. And it's a documentary called The End of the Line. And basically, it's a documentary which discusses how what we've done to make overfishing become the problem that it is today and how we can kind of move past it into a time where we can start, you know, using our fish resource responsibly.
And this issue has special significance for British Columbians.
Well, that's right. Canada is actually the world's fourth largest seafood exporter, so this is a big deal for us. And it's been all over the news lately, especially how our salmon stocks have started to dwindle. And we are really hoping that we don't see a collapse of our salmon stocks like we've seen on the East Coast with Atlantic cod, which obviously just devastated the industry and was terrible for communities out there. So we hope to not have that same thing happen out here in BC.
Could you give a little background for our listeners, people who might not know a lot about how the fishing industry currently works in BC?
Well, Canada has always prided itself on being more progressive. And the problem is that a lot of the fish from BC actually come from other places too, and that's a problem because it's harder to regulate. Well, we can regulate, you know, certain fishing practices here in BC. It's hard to regulate fish that's coming from other parts of the world, and there's various countries out there that have different rules about fishing, and that can make it hard for us to kind of balance the our desire to maintain our fishing industry with our desire to be environmentally friendly. So that's really tough. And right now in the whole world, we're taking 2.5 times the amount of fish from the oceans than is currently sustainable. And what that means is that ultimately our fish stocks are doomed to collapse unless we start changing it. And Canada has been really great in trying to, you know, make new marine reserves and areas where there's absolutely no fishing allowed, but there needs to be a much greater effort in that department, and that's one of the things that the film talks about.
So if we want to change how things are, who needs to take charge? Is this a question for the government that they need to regulate fish imports? Is it a question for consumers? Is it a question for grocery stores?
Well, it's a little bit of both. Greenpeace's stance has been that we realize that we can't, you know, police the entire oceans, and we can't make sure that everybody is using the fishing practices that we'd like. And when I talk about bad fishing practices, what I'm talking about can be anything from, you know, fishing species that are, you know, nearly extinct, like bluefin or yellowfin tuna or shark, or, you know, it could even be using bad fishing practices, which can include bottom trawling, which is basically when you drop a giant net to the bottom of the ocean and you scrape everything up and hope that you catch some of the fish that you're hunting for. And then everything else, which is dead when you pull it up, just gets tossed back into the ocean and is basically just trash, right? So that's really bad because those nets can be as wide as a football field, you know, in length and as tall as a three-story building. So if you're imagining, you know, thousands of boats running around with these in the ocean, just dragging these along for miles and miles, you can imagine the ecological damage to the ocean floor. But everybody can do their part in their own way. And one of the best things to do is just eat lower down on the food chain. If you can give those large predatory species of fish a rest, you know, every once in a while, that can really help kind of preserve those fish stocks and help them kind of bounce back and revitalize. Also, sending letters to your supermarket. The supermarkets are the ones who are giving out these, you know, or who are selling this fish, and we need to really kind of make them stop buying the fish from wholesalers, and the wholesalers will not be fishing for the fish, and that's how we really kind of decrease the demand for fish that are caught in an unsustainable way. So everybody can start, you know, they can start simply by sending a letter to your supermarket and saying, I like shopping at your supermarket, but I want you to be only selling sustainable fish. That's a great way to start.
So from a consumer's point of view, how do you know which fish are sustainable and which ones aren't?
Well, actually, Greenpeace is a very comprehensive, what we call our red list, which is a list of fish that are on there for any number of ways. The fish on our red list can be there because, you know, the production method has negative impacts on a certain species or any other marine species, too. If sometimes there are porpoises that can get caught in these large trawling nets, and there's, you know, all kinds of marine life that is basically what we call bycatch, which means that it's caught kind of, but it's not what's intended to be caught, right? So, you know, there's many reasons why a fish could be on our red list, but all the fish that are on there are unsustainable. So that's a good way to know which fish not to buy. And the Vancouver Aquarium actually has a very good list of restaurants that are selling sustainable seafood. They have a list that's similar to ours, I think, but they also have like lists of places where you can go and buy fish that's been sustainably caught, various supermarkets and stores that sell fish that's been sustainably caught. So that's a good place to start. You just have to start paying a little more attention to what you eat.
I think the Vancouver Aquarium program is called Oceanwise, I believe.
That's right, yeah.
But Oceanwise restaurants aside, for the average consumer, how practical is it to when you're eating out, find which seafood on the menu is sustainable and what's not? Because I've looked at these guides, and it'll be like, Atlantic salmon is okay, but Pacific salmon, not okay.
Right, right.
If it's long line caught, it's okay, but if it's short line, it's not. Obviously, I don't know, but there's a lot of subtleties and specifics.
Right, that's a good question, and I could be wrong about this, so don't take my word for it exactly. But I'm fairly sure that when you do go out, you can ask the manager or you can ask the waiter, was this seafood sustainably caught? And I'm pretty sure that the rules in Vancouver state that they have to have records of what kind of, you know, how their fish is caught. Now, I'm not sure about that, and if not, then that's something that we should start moving towards, is having that be a standard across the board. But yeah, I mean, I realize that it's hard, especially, you know, if you go out and you order, you know, sushi and it has salmon in it, you don't know if it's going to be Atlantic salmon or, you know, Chinook or sockeye salmon from out here, if it's farmed salmon that's been farmed out here. And it's hard to tell. And that's a big part of what makes this such a tough problem to deal with. So we really kind of have to start at a at a level where everybody is kind of taking a personal responsibility towards moving away from unsustainable seafood.
What would you say to somebody who says grassroots action is great, but if we really want to make change in this issue, it has to be on the international level, conventions, treaties?
Well,
like.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big thing for us is that Greenpeace is largely a lobbying organization. So the bulk of what we do is, as an overall organization, is try and lobby government, lobby, you know, supermarkets, lobby, you know, private entities and public entities to start being more environmentally aware and environmentally conscious. And what that can mean is talking to the government and saying, look, we need harsher restrictions on what seafood is being sold in our stores and what seafood is being brought into our country.
And also, I know that for you, sustainable seafood is also tied into climate change. Mm-hmm. Could you speak to that quickly?
Well, I mean, basically, if you're ever looking at any large amount of biomass that is being destroyed, like can happen with bottom trawling, that's going to have a negative impact. And the oceans actually absorb a huge amount of CO2. And people don't realize that this is kind of just like a forest or just like any other large, you know, natural body that's absorbing a lot of CO2. If you start messing with it in a bad way, you're going to have some negative results and you're going to start having negative impacts in resulting in climate change.
Great. Well, thank you very much for speaking with us. If listeners want more information or they want to see the film?
Well, if they'd like to see the film, again, it's in Buchanan B310 at 6 o'clock on Wednesday, November 18th. And it's free to anybody who would like to come. And if anybody is interested in joining the UBC Greenpeace Association, we're on Facebook. We have a group of the same name. So, yeah, we look forward to seeing a lot of people out there for the documentary.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Carrie.
It's now time for some public service announcements, but stay tuned for more local and campus news. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
I believe I've survived for a reason to tell my story to touch lives.
Hip-hop artist Emmanuel Jal, once a child soldier in Sudan, has returned to his home country, and this time his weapon is a microphone. His unique story and effort to build peace, War Child, is just one of the 25 films featured this year at the Amnesty International Film Festival, November 12th to 15th at the Van City Theater, 1181 Seymour Street. Full program available at amnestyfilmfest.ca. Brought to you in part by CITR Radio.
Me, I got a reason for being on this earth, cause no more than many words, life is worth enough. Now that I get a chance to stand my ground, I'm gonna run over mountains, leaps and bounds.
From November 16th to 27th, CITR will be hosting a two-week video game competition. On the main floor of the sub, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., Miss Pac-Man and Galaga will be set up. $2 to play. Highest scores of the day get a limited edition CITR Fun Drive t-shirt. Highest scores at the end of the 2 weeks gets a trip to Las Vegas, courtesy of Travel Cuts. So come and be old school.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots, global, unembedded, international, independent news hour.
Award-winning journalist Amy Goodman is on a national speaking tour to mark Democracy Now!'s 13th anniversary and launch her new book, Breaking the Sound Barrier. Come see Amy speak, grab a copy of her new book, and support your local community and campus radio stations all at the same time. This event's a fundraiser, so all proceeds go to support the broadcasting operations of CITR 101.9 FM, Co-op 102.7 FM, and CJSF 90.1 FM. Democracy Now! Can be heard on these three Vancouver campus and community stations.
Tickets are available at Banyan Books and Sound, Spartacus Books, People's Co-op Books, and Sophia Books, Zulu Records, and Red Cat Records. Join us Wednesday, November 25th at Vancouver Public Library in the Alice McKay Room, 350 West Georgia Street. The event is at 7 p.m. Doors are at 6:30.
Welcome back. You're listening to News 101, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building here at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight. Yesterday, CITR kicked off its annual fund drive, so I'd like to take this opportunity to remind you that we are a non-commercial station. That means we are not owned by a huge media corporation. That also means that we are free to bring you the news the way we see it. We don't have to worry about offending a corporate sponsor or a big media head honcho. And we'd like to keep it that way. So please call 604-822-8648 to help keep quality independent programming on the air. That's 604-822-8648 or donate online at citr.ca. We will also be giving away 3 albums from some fantastic bands to those who call and pledge at the 101.9 level, $101.90. If you call us now at 604-822-8648, you can choose from Aude Bijou's new album, Beacons, Dinosaur Jr.'s Farm, or Animal Collective, Meriwether Post Pavilion. Call and pledge now, 604-822-8648. Last Friday, provincial authorities moved ahead with plans to demolish the Little Mountain Housing Complex, a low-income housing complex located at the corner of East 33rd in Ontario. The demolition went ahead despite concerns raised by a group of residents and housing advocates known as Community Advocates for Little Mountain, or CALM. This Tuesday, a fire broke out at the site, destroying one unoccupied building. The fire, police are calling it suspicious. To find out more, our own Janelle Chung spoke to Lauren Gill, a representative for CALM.
Little Mountain is 37 buildings that comprise 224 units of social housing for low and modest income families. It's been around since the 1970s. It's been around quite a while. And up until 2 years ago, it was a well-functioning community, and BC Housing decided to sell off the public land to private interest to develop more money for social housing. Rich Coleman decided that they were going to put it up for sale, and the plan was to have it redeveloped. They said at that point 2 to 4 years, they were going to have one-for-one replacement, and it was going to be mixed housing, so low and modest incomes as well as people who, you know, could afford to own condos. So that was the original plan. Now, they chose to do it in the midst of Vancouver's worst housing crisis since the Depression. So off the bat, it was a bad idea, in my opinion.
So do you think that they don't have a clear plan on what's happening, or that they're not going to follow through on what they're saying?
Well, I think they will replace them one for one. We just found out last week that the Holborn, the company that bought out the land that will be building the housing, they've just given us a timeline of 10 years until they build the housing. So basically what happened, and there could have been ways that they could have gone about doing it. They could have done phased redevelopment where they kept families there and built slowly while they moved people back into the new housing. But what Holborn said that they wouldn't buy the land until it was all the tenants had been evicted and the buildings were knocked down. So that's what they're in the process of doing right now. There's 7 remaining families, and there's still 34 buildings on the property that are being heated, but they're empty. So they basically, the plan was to get it down and get it up quickly. Now, because of the downturn in the economy, unfortunately, they were looking at 10 years, and the 224 people, families that were displaced from that community were put into BC Housing units that other people on the BC Housing wait list had been waiting for years. So this move has pushed down the BC Housing wait list. I don't know the exact amount of time, but I'm thinking it's probably a good year or two those people will be waiting extra.
Right. Yeah. And the Little Mountain residents have been displaced around Metro Vancouver.
So some of them have been put into other housing projects, like Skeena Terrace and Strathcona Housing. So they've, for a lot of the families, there was a school right around the corner that I guess one of the big concerns for them was that their kids would have to move schools. They wouldn't have, you know, people with low and modest income to be able to have affordable child care is huge, and in that community, people looked after each other's children. So now they're having to look for, you know, child care in Vancouver, which if you're a mother, you know, or a father in that case, you know how difficult it can be to find, you know, affordable child care. So
they've also said that the money from the sale, half of it is going to finance social housing in Vancouver, while the other half is going to subsidize housing in the rest of BC.
Yes.
What do you think about that?
I think that it's embarrassing almost, and it's a travesty that our provincial government thinks that we have to sell off our land to be able to generate income for social housing. I mean, in 1993, we had a national social housing program, you know, that provided 2,500 units of social housing every year.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I believe it was Liberal governments that was in power at the time that pulled it out. And, you know, we have money for housing. We have the Housing Endowment Fund, the City of Vancouver does, that's mm-hmm. sitting and collecting interest right now. I mean, we have money for housing. So why are we selling off beautiful, perfectly livable housing in the midst of a housing crisis? It's just, it's so backwards to me.
Mm-hmm.
It makes no sense. So
there is a lot of controversy behind it.
Mm-hmm.
Some people think that the prime real estate should be given to, you know, condominiums, and then that affordable housing should be moved further out of the city. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't think that's really what BC Housing's... that's not what their idea was. What they wanted to do and what they were going to do was have one-for-one replacement. So there was still going to be social housing there when it was rebuilt.
Mm-hmm.
But it was going to be mixed housing, so there were going to be condos there as well. Because it is prime real estate. It's right next to Queenie Park. It's a beautiful, beautiful view from there.
Mm-hmm.
As for moving it out of the city, I haven't heard too much of that. Of course, there's always the not-in-my-backyard groups that don't want social housing or social services in their neighborhood. But a Little Mountain actually was,
mm-hmm.
it functioned quite well with the rest of the community. It was a really beautiful thing that was going on there.
And then last Friday,
mm-hmm.
they've started demolition on the site.
Yep.
And then there were some protesters out there. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. When they started the demolition, I think at this point, you know, there are some of us who would like to stop the demolition, and there's some of us who think at this point there is no stopping the demolition.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a mixed crowd that was there, and I think a lot of people were there just to bear witness to to the event and to, you know, how the travesty and how sad it is to see this housing go to waste
mm-hmm.
and sit empty for 10 years. I mean, we, at this point, you know, what I believe personally,
mm-hmm.
I think that it's going to be used as an Olympic parking lot because there's a venue very close by that has no parking in the area. So, you know, just the fact that people are sleeping outside and we're making space for cars to park for an Olympic venue that won't be benefiting anyone, like, it's sad. It's really sad for me to see so. And during the 10 years, what the developer has put forward is to build a community garden, which in most people's eyes, it looks great. I mean, I live in the community and I would love to have a garden that I could tend to, but the only reason that they're doing that is because they get a huge tax cut
mm-hmm.
if they have a garden there. So, I mean, why are they really doing it? For the community or for themselves? And, you know, at this point, we don't need gardens if we don't have people in homes. I mean, homeless people don't garden that often.
Tuesday night, there was a fire that broke out on the site.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I got a phone call, I think, around 6 o'clock, and a two-alarm fire had broken out at Little Mountain, and I got up there pretty quickly. It was still in blaze. It burnt down
mm-hmm.
in a matter of probably about 15 minutes, and there was a lot of people talking, a lot of speculation as to how the fire started, and I guess this morning I was just reading the Metro newspaper, and they said that it is, they believe it was arson. So, I mean, any empty building that's sitting around is a target for,
mm-hmm.
for arsonists. Now, there's a lot of speculation that, well, could it have been the protesters, or, which to me doesn't make any sense. It's like PETA lighting animals on fire. Why would housing activists burn down housing? I mean, it's completely backwards. But then there's also the idea that maybe the demolition crews, you know, taking out asbestos from buildings and tearing them down piece by piece is quite expensive. It's a lot easier just to burn it down. Now, and we've seen that happen many times in demolition across Canada, at least. So,
mm-hmm.
But at this point, we don't know. So,
did the fire break out in the unoccupied buildings? Because there are still people living on the site, right?
Yeah, the people that are living on the site are on the southeast side, and this was on
mm-hmm.
the northwest side.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, yeah, fortunately, there was nobody inside. The thing that just boggles my mind is that there's 8 security guards on it at a time.
Mm.
And, you know, they are like, mind my swearing, they're like flies on shit. I mean, you cannot walk onto that property without them jumping on you. And I know from personal experience, camping out there the other night, we had a protest. We tented out there for a night.
Mm-hmm.
And they are all over you. So I don't see how anyone could get past there and light a fire. And then, of course, there was a fire this morning at Broadway in Maine.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, I guess this morning when I heard of that, I kind of thought, well, maybe it's a series of fires and then arsonist is just kind of taking it as an opportunity to, I don't know, you know, at this
mm-hmm.
point we don't know. So
are there any last comments that you'd like to say?
I think that at this point right now, like I said, saving the buildings, I don't know if that's possible, but BC Housing is currently, and the provincial government is currently targeting other social housing units in Vancouver to do the same thing too. And as we can all see, nothing good has come out of this. And I think it's our duty as citizens of Vancouver, regardless of our income or whether or not we're homeless, to protect that housing and to protect housing in Vancouver and to look after and take care of our community. So I urge anyone to join our movement and to stand up against the provincial government and tell them that, you know, we don't ever want this to happen again, you know, and that that we want to keep our affordable housing in Vancouver. So, yeah.
Okay. Thanks so much for talking
Great.
With us, Lauren.
No problem.
That was Lauren Gill, a member of Community Advocates for Little Mountain. I'm Carrie Baptist, reminding you that CITR is currently in the midst of its annual fund drive. Without CITR, Vancouver would lose an essential source of independent music and spoken word programming. CITR brings you a hard-to-find niche and diverse music which commercial radio just doesn't play. So for all these reasons and many more, we're asking you to pick up the phone and call 604-822-8648 to donate. We're now going to take a quick break, but stay tuned. Up next, we bring you an interview with SFU criminology professor Neil Boyd, right after these public service announcements.
KRAP Radio, giving you the same crap all the time. Here's BEP for the fifth time.
Man, is there anywhere I can tune into where I don't hear the same god-awful song 10 times in an hour?
Yeah, CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
They kind of need money, don't they?
They do. And if you appreciate great music, here's some reasons why you should donate. You can hear music of every genre on CITR. We support Vancouver's local music community. CITR has no commercial mainstream content. Our music programming focuses on Canadian content and aims for gender balance on air.
We need your support to continue providing you with the best independent, eclectic music programming possible.
Call 604-822-8648 or UBC Unit.
And I was crying on the staircase, begging you, please let's go. And I said, Juliet, take me to Scientine's GIR. All we gotta do is go and register on the Scienteam website, scienteam.ubc. It's a job maker, baby, just say yes.
SciTeam presents Get Into Research, November 19th in Woodward, IRC, with keynote by Jamie Matthews, Officer of the Order of Canada, and workshops on NSERC, co-op, and volunteering. GIR will get you that job and research you've always wanted. Be there.
This is News 101, and the current time is 5:30. Former Vancouver Mayor Larry Campbell, SFU Professor Neil Boyd, and journalist Laurie Culbert recently collaborated on the book 1,000 Dreams, which makes suggestions on how to improve the current situation in Vancouver's downtown east side. The book challenges readers to view drug addiction as a medical problem rather than a crime. Earlier this week, Megan Turcato spoke with co-author Neil Boyd.
Why did you believe this was a book that needed to be written?
I think that the downtown east side of Vancouver is an area that's subject to a lot of misconceptions. We wanted to demonstrate that this is a resilient community, a community that has a good deal of pride. We also wanted to address, address through improving understanding of how and why the downtown east side of Vancouver has become the way it is. This was the central area of the city in 1900. It was the business center. You can look at the old stone buildings and recognize that this was the center of commerce. And the book, in many ways, is a description of how and why that area has changed so dramatically in the space of about 110 years.
Okay, so one of the central themes in your book is that drug addiction is a health problem and not a crime. I know you wrote a whole book about this, but can you maybe summarize the arguments for this position?
Yeah, I think we need to recognize that the line between legal and illegal drugs is a product of economics, culture, history. It's not a product of differences with respect to morality or with respect to public health risks. In fact, the drug that was actively promoted for many years, tobacco, is probably the most lethal drug of all. That is, it's most likely to end your life prematurely, more so than all of the illegal drugs, though certainly injecting drugs like heroin and cocaine can cause pretty significant risk. But overall, there's no more dangerous or more lethal drug than tobacco. We've actually made incredible strides with tobacco, not through criminal prohibition, but through aggressive non-smokers' rights initiatives, through public education, through regulation of use of the drug. And I think each drug has to be considered on its own terms. And so you go down the list of drugs, and I think you need to be clear about what risks they represent and how they are best regulated. I think the idea that you would use the criminal law to control what a person puts into his or her body is a kind of ludicrous concept, ultimately. It doesn't help. I'm certainly not suggesting that the drugs are entirely benign. They're not. But the point is, what's the best mechanism for controlling drugs? It seems to me that it's a regulatory apparatus rather than an apparatus of prohibition.
And can you maybe extrapolate a little bit on what that regulatory apparatus would be?
Well, it would be different for each drug. I mean, I think we have a pretty good sense of how we're regulating tobacco. Cannabis would be somewhat similar to tobacco. You know, these are, if you smoke cannabis or you smoke tobacco, best done in private with consenting adults.
To bring this back to the Downtown East Side, what impact would a more liberal drug policy, including things like talked about more research into heroin?
Yeah, I'm not sure it's a more liberal drug policy. Mm-hmm. I would say, because it always, you know, that begs the question of what it means to be liberal. Mm-hmm. I think it's a smarter, more productive, less costly strategy than the strategy we're currently employing. But in the Downtown East Side, you know, drugs are a part of the problem, but they're only a relatively small part of a bigger issue of people with mental health and substance abuse, substance addiction issues. We've deinstitutionalized, that is, in Canada and the United States over the last 30 years. A lot of people have left the confines of mental hospitals and the like and made their way into the streets. And while there were very good reasons for deinstitutionalization, we haven't put the resources in place for people who have these difficulties. And so we see a lot more homelessness in Canada. And that's because we've done two things. We've deinstitutionalized over the past 30 years, and we've failed to keep up with our original commitments to building supportive housing. Supportive housing is housing for people who have pretty significant problems and who need support, people for whom it's not enough just to put a roof over their head. We stopped. In 1993, the Chrétien government stopped building supportive housing, and there's been no uptake since that time at the federal level. When we see, you know, over the past 30 or 40 years that we've got this growing problem of homelessness, I have to step back and ask, well, where did this come from? It didn't just pop up because people decided that they were going to wander the streets. I mean, we created this problem by failing to build supportive housing and by deinstitutionalizing. Based on any number of estimates, we need to build hundreds, if not thousands, of supportive housing units in Vancouver alone.
So in A Thousand Dreams, Larry Campbell defends his decision to bring the Olympics to Vancouver.
Right.
But a lot of people are really critical of that and the loss of housing that they believe has gone along with that. How do you think that the impacts, the Olympics are going to impact the Downtown East Side?
The Olympics are for 2 weeks, mm-hmm. and people aren't being pushed out of their houses for 2 weeks. The primary change that you see in Vancouver as a consequence of the Olympics is that wealthy people who own their own homes are renting those homes, apartments, or townhouses out for 2 weeks at exorbitant rates and profiting from doing so. The Expo 86, which lasted for 5 months, had a significant impact on housing in the Downtown East Side. It diminished the housing stock, certainly, during and after its presence. But the Olympics has really got very little, if anything, to do with the housing stock. People aren't being forced out. There are some concerns that people may be, people who are homeless and who are unsightly may be forced into shelters during the Olympic period, but I really don't think the Olympics have much to do with the housing stock.
So you just think that the activists that are decrying this loss of housing are wrongly attributing it to the Olympics?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I have to say that I wasn't a big fan of the Olympics at the start. Like, I wouldn't have advocated strongly for it. But now, once that it's here, I don't understand why anybody would take the position that we should try to make it worse, or that we should try to make it anything but a success. It seems to me that we're only going to hurt ourselves if the Olympics is a costly failure.
So, given the multitude of problems that you were mentioning, that kind of overlapping addiction and mental health and problems with HIV and AIDS related to drug use and stuff like that, a lot of people hear the argument that the Downtown East Side is kind of a money pit and that we should be, you know, spending our money somewhere else. What would you say to that argument?
Well, you know, it's a money pit. Not really. I mean, you know, people at the bottom of the economic pile still have a very small percentage of resources relative to the people at the top, in the top 10 or 20%. And if you look at Statistics Canada reports from 1975 to the present, what we can see is that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. So when people say about the residents of the Downtown East Side, who are disproportionately poor, that they are a money pit, that there is an endless drain on resources, it seems to me that misunderstands the reality, that the money we're spending on the poor has been diminishing over time and not increasing. But we have a government in Ottawa at the moment which is committed to incarcerating hundreds of drug offenders under Bill C-15. They're going to spend $75,000 a year to put thousands more Canadians in jail. Many of the people who will be convicted under this section are, of course, not the kingpins of the drug industry, but small-time user dealers on the Downtown East Side, for example, who have a host of mental health and substance abuse issues. So we might ask the question, what's the best strategy for dealing with these troubled, compromised people? Is it to incarcerate them, or is it to provide them with mechanisms of support?
So you don't believe that, I guess, for a lot of addicts, that there's ever a hope of getting rid of or getting over this addiction, that it's something they're just going to have to maintain, or...
Well, no, that's a good question. I think, in fact, there's quite a range of substance abuse, and we can see it ourselves when we think about something like alcohol. About 10% of the people who drink to a point where they have significant problems with alcohol, but 20% of Canadians don't drink at all, and then the rest are somewhere in between. If you think about the illegal drugs with the same kind of framework, I think you can begin to see how we address the problem. For some people, abstinence is the best policy. For other people, they can control their consumption. With cannabis, for example, the majority of people who consume quite irregularly. Then you get a group of people who have some difficulties with it, who are dependent on it, who use it every day or more often than that. And similarly, you know, you can look at heroin, the same kind of range. Each drug's different, of course, and you'd have a different approach. But we should have a big tent on responding to problems of substance abuse and addiction, everywhere from a kind of maintenance to abstinence. And sometimes that means tolerance of a certain kind of drug use. What we're doing now, by criminalizing certain drugs and not having that criminalization based on public health but on our political history, we're making the situation much worse, and we're not addressing the public health problems that result, for example, from intravenous injection. So we need a more focused drug-specific response, and we need to recognize that treating the problems associated with drug consumption requires a recognition that there is a range of consumption. Some drugs, like tobacco, you know, we've actually said to people who have addictions to tobacco, well, we've got a nicotine patch, at least that gets rid of the smoke. You've still got some health risk with nicotine, but, you know, that's all quite rational. We engage in quite rational decision-making around tobacco and alcohol. Not entirely, but quite rational. We don't even begin to be rational when it comes to illegal drugs. We just say, no, all of them should be criminally prohibited, and we don't look at the consequences that criminal prohibition creates.
What do you think that legalization of a common drug like marijuana would do to, I guess, patterns of consumption and supply?
I don't think it would have much impact. I mean, it's difficult to know entirely. You can go to places like the Netherlands, where people have been able to buy it without criminal prosecution for 30, almost 40 years. And you find there that rates of consumption are actually lower than in Canada, the United States, or the UK.
So to bring it back to the downtown east side, what do you think that, given all these trends, the future holds for this neighborhood?
Well, I think in many ways there are reasons for optimism. You look at InSight, which was is a health initiative put in by Vancouver Coastal Health, and you look at the nonprofit societies, the Portland Hotel Society, Rain City. There are so many people doing so much good work. It's a very resilient community. It's a very tolerant community. So there's much to be hopeful about. At the same time, however, the federal government is really the elephant in the room and is really the organization that has contributed least and is actually an obstacle to any kind of progressive movement. And I say this because of the views that they take with respect to drugs, but also with respect to their failure to build supportive housing. They believe that drug use and mental illness are moral failures. They don't look carefully at the evidence, and they see that the polls tell them that getting tough on drug offenders is politically popular. They're ideologically committed to a relatively punitive worldview, and so they're quite happy to go down that road.
Okay, thanks for talking to me today.
You bet. Thanks.
That was Neil Boyd, SFU professor and co-author of A Thousand Dreams. To hear the longer, uncut version of his interview, including his thoughts on Stephen Harper, please go to our website, www.citr.ca. It's time for another break. Up next is weather. But I would just like to take this time to remind you that CITR also supports the arts community. We feature in-depth reporting on Vancouver's arts, and that's every Wednesday on the Arts Report and also on News 101. CITR needs your support to make sure the local arts community has an independent media ally. I would like to give a huge shout-out to Linda, who just gave us a meaningful and amazing donation. So if you would like to join Linda and support CITR, give us a call, 604-822-8646. Again, the number, 604-822-8646, or donate online at citr.ca.
Hi, I'm Tyler Noble, reporter and anchor at CKNW News Talk 980. CITR helped me pursue a career in radio broadcasting by providing a fun, encouraging atmosphere that gave me the confidence to succeed on air. Let's be honest, when I showed up for my first day at CITR, it was pretty rough. But hey, we all start somewhere, and that's what makes a campus and community radio station like this so special. Like many others, I got a warm welcome when I became a CITR member, and I remain actively involved as the station's sports director. So, please support CITR during this very important fund drive by calling 604-822-8648. That's 604-UBC-UNIT. Or donate securely online at citr.ca/donate. Thank you for your generous contribution.
CITR's Audio Text presents a night of spoken word featuring R.C. Wislowski.
Just Google yourself to find you are about 3,833,000 kaleidoscopic diamonds in a worldwide net of gems.
Daniel Mark Patterson.
Your soul, sicken, sear, scorch, sizzle, and fizzle as madcap manic metaphors mortify mold and melt your mindscape.
Chris Gilpin.
Sweet, noble Sasquatch, come back to me. I won't apologize for the time I called your sister abominable.
Steve Miller.
I like you!
I like you. Oh, no.
Fernando Ruggiero.
His girlfriend brought it up. See, I was trying to go straight, trying to find more dignified, sophisticated subjects for a poem, like a kid picking his nose in an intersection.
Sonia Littlejohn.
Our drumbeat rhythm hearts ignite the souls of embryos and carry life into existence.
And Julie Peters, the host of Audio Text.
Is it any sweeter, is it any hotter, does it really turn me on to see me sorry, to see me stuttering, to see me lose my words before the imminent journey of my human body audience?
Cover is $5 to $10. Pay what you can and support CITR during this fun drive. Join us for this great event on Thursday, November 19th, 9 p.m. at St. Augustine's, 2360 Commercial Drive.
Welcome Welcome back to News 101. I'm Carrie Baptist, coming to you live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight. Right now, it's 5:48 and time to go to the arts. Sorry, time to go to the weather. And for that, here's Denise Diatic.
Here's your weekend weather forecast for November 13th to 15th. Tonight should be mostly clear and frosty, with 40 to 50 kilometer northeast winds that should level off by late evening. Low of negative 1 degrees. Cloudiness will increase by Saturday, with rain in the evening that could actually turn to wet snow. Wind will also increase by evening, up to 50 kilometers. High of 5 degrees, low of negative 1. Sunday will warm up, comparatively. Cloudy with frequent rain, though be heavy towards the mountains, again accompanied by wind. High of 2, low of 12. Also, I would like to draw your attention to an exciting event happening on November 17, 2009, which is this Tuesday. The Lenoid meteor shower is due to occur, and this year should give a good display. Lenoids, are a bit of debris left by Comet 55P Temple Tuttle, creating meteor streams. The one that the Earth is passing through this year was laid down in 1466. So, hopefully it's not cloudy, and we will be able to watch the fireballs. All right, now it's time for some weather trivia. And to do this, I will introduce Ashley Aparocho.
Thanks, Denise. So the question is, which Canadian place / territory has the dubious honor of holding Canada's record for lowest temperature recorded? In this condition, a breath of air would hiss, crackle, and freeze, and create extended vapor trails. Any skin exposed would freeze in less than 3 minutes.
Thank you, Ashley. We will reveal the answer on next week's show. Currently, it's 5 degrees and cloudy at YVR. That's your forecast for the weekend, brought to you by the Storm Club of UBC. For News 101, we're Denise Diatic
and Ashley Aparocho.
Thanks, guys. And that's our program for November 13th, 2009. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Intercato produced this radio program. For more news, join us next Monday at 5 for another edition of News 101. Here at CITR, I'm Carrie Baptist, and thanks for listening. Stay tuned for play-by-play sports right here on CITR 101.9 FM.